Welcome to the second EIR strategic seminar this year here in Berlin. My name is Michael Liebig from the EIR office in Wiesbaden, and I will chair the morning and afternoon session, and then Dr. Tenenbaum will take over. So I'm very happy that we have here this morning a distinguished representatives from science and politics out of the following countries, and I'll list them in approximate geographic order from east to west. So we have representatives from science and politics from Russia, China, India, Egypt, Israel, from Hungary, from Croatia, from Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Poland, Italy, France, Germany, and the United States. If we look back 6 months to the first strategic seminar here in Berlin, the 12th and the 13th of January, then I think we will realize the tectonic shifts which have taken place during those 6 months. In January, most of the participants at that seminar came here with the firm assumption that 4 more years of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney carved in stone, that's the reality. And in the course of the seminar, it emerged that the reality in the United States is rather different through what Mr. LaRouche was telling you then in particular. And we have seen that the prognosis which he gave then, 6 months ago, has materialized in the sense that the Bush-Cheney administration and the neocon structures behind them have run into a almost unbelievable strategic and economic disaster. We have seen emerging since a sort of dual power situation between the U.S. Senate and the Bush-Cheney White House. The Senate evolving into a new political center of gravity in U.S. politics, a center of gravity catalyzed and directed by Mr. LaRouche. So, at the same time, in Europe, we have seen also there tectonic changes. Think about the world of Europe, the European Union, 6 months ago. We, within these very days, here in Berlin, the modalities for early elections to the Bundestag are being worked out. We have had on the 29th of May the referendum on the European Union Constitution Treaty in France, which was rejected, and with that rejection, the very Maastricht structure receiving a blow from which it will not recover. We've seen at the same time here in Europe a enormous policy vacuum and political leadership vacuum. And as we've seen that from within the political class in Europe, there's this or that reasonable political initiative, but we see the recoiling from the fundamental issue, and that is state investment programs which will in the short term decisively reduce mass unemployment in Europe. And without resolving that issue, nothing else in Europe is going to work. Now, we will hear more on that question of policy vacuum and leadership vacuum by Helga Zeppler-Rusch and by Jacques Geminat in the course of this day. Now, this all is occurring within the context of something which we very intensively did already discuss in January, and that is the systemic economic, financial, and monetary crisis. But that crisis in the course of the past 6 months has decisively intensified and accelerated further. And it reached the point where the has reached the point where the very system, the very regime of globalization has demonstrated, even to people who were in denial until very recently, that it is intolerable and unsustainable. So this seminar here hopefully will, I'm sure it will, in the course of the discussion of today and tomorrow morning, be able to identify new flanks for a grand design and for a new type of transatlantic Eurasian relations. And I would say that the past 6 months should have taught us that do not take anything for granted. And with this, I want to ask Lynn to give us his lecture this morning.
I shall read part of this from text, which was done essentially to simplify the tasks of translators. And otherwise, I shall have, in the proportion of reading the text, I shall have one substantial and crucial interpolation. And then at the close of the preliminary remarks, I shall then turn to a more scientific aspect of the matter, the proof of the argument which I make, or the essential proof. In all of the most deadly crises in world history, the greatest threat to mankind is not what leading opinion does not know. In actuality, the highest degree of danger was always created, as at the present time, by the arrogance of those governments and leading bodies of public opinion, which had already been, in fact, the long-standing principal cause of the suddenly threatened disaster of today. Among the small-minded variety of political and other authorities, for whom the prospects of a personal career and wealth are overriding, it is the personal gains, not the consequences of one's behavior for future generations, which are considered primary. So history often passes judgment on small-minded ambition and on governments which, like many today, have thought no further ahead than the next change in government. Bear that thought in mind as you consider the following report on those mistakes of four decades which have produced the present immediate threat to civilization as a whole. An event of the most profound quality of global strategic implications occurred within the U.S. Senate this past May 23rd. This event, for which I was merely an implied but extremely relevant factor, prevented an attempted Bush administration coup d'etat against the U.S. Constitution. This threat of a White House-steered overthrow of the U.S. Constitution reflected the severity of a worldwide crisis, which had occurred in large part as a reflection of the global hedge fund and related international banking crisis, which had been detonated by the collapse of the U.S. auto giants General Motors and Ford. The character and significance of this May 23rd event has gone virtually unrecognized in most of the leading European press and in public statements of most among its leading political figures. Yet even during the relatively short term immediately ahead, the future of the nations of Europe and elsewhere now depend upon the new crucial decisions which must be made inside the United States, made against the background of the May 23rd action by the U.S. Senate. As a significant number of you here today already know, my mission in Berlin this week was planned months in advance in knowledge of the certainty that a state of global crisis would be hitting Europe in particular by mid-June. The purpose of that mission already then as now is to make clear the most essential of those urgent issues which must be placed on the highest level of consideration by the responsible governments and political organizations of Europe. This clarification must include emphasis on certain presently crucial strategic facts about the nature and role of the United States, facts which are largely not understood, even among leading governmental and other relevant circles in continental Europe. To reduce what is an otherwise complex subject to essentials, which could be reviewed within the allotted time frame of several days provided, I shall now present you with a summation of four pivotal issues whose importance cannot be doubted by intelligence circles once even the barest of the relevant essential facts are presented, as I do on this occasion. The most immediate danger to world peace and stability would be the admittedly existing potentiality that the government of the United States would refuse to take certain sudden and sweeping emergency measures which are now, in fact, absolutely necessary actions of the immediate future if we are to prevent the entire planet from being plunged into a chain reaction form of monetary, financial, and economic breakdown crisis by a sudden collapse in the value of the dollar-denominated assets worldwide. Largely as a result of more than three decades of the combination of a floating exchange rate monetary system, the past 15 years spread of the use of financial derivatives, and the recent WTO-led plunge into a lemming-like lunacy of globalization, the world as a whole is now more ripe for a threatened chain reaction breakdown crisis of the world's economic as well as monetary financial systems. Under these present conditions, unprecedented in all modern history, unless the U.S. itself is prepared to force a return to a fixed exchange rate dollar system like that of the 1945-1963 interval, there is no possibility that any part of this planet as a whole could escape the effects of a global breakdown crisis of the present world system. The actions which the United States must take, the United States must unilaterally, but with consultation with its friends abroad, act to prevent a collapse of the U.S. dollar, a sudden collapse in the magnitude of 10% to 30%, which is now imminent. In view of the role of the dollar as the world's still monetary reserve currency, and in view of the large amounts of obligations denominated in dollars held by China, held by Japan, held by Europe, and others, that a collapse of the U.S. dollar now, of the type which is imminently threatened, would not bring on merely a new depression. It would bring on a general breakdown crisis of the world system. Therefore, the crucial question is, what action is the United States going to proffer, and how is the United West of the world going to respond to this proffer of a U.S.-led return to a fixed exchange rate monetary system? This means that the only solution for this kind of problem is to return to a fixed exchange rate system and to rolling over existing dollar obligations by converting them from essentially short-term to medium-term obligations to a system of long-term obligations. In other words, a fixed-rate system of long-term obligations. We're talking about a period of 25 to 50 years, essentially two generations. If we mix the rolling over of these present obligations with the generation of new credits, also in a fixed exchange rate, in the amount required to expand production and trade on a world scale over a period of 50 years, we can safely get through this period from this point on and expect a period of general growth. There is no other alternative at this time. Because of the complexity and because of the insanity of destruction of national sovereignty, you no longer have buffers among states where one state goes out under and others do not necessarily go under with the same degree. Today, if this world, if the dollar goes down, every part of this planet will go down in a chain reaction formation. That could not be prevented. The only thing that could prevent it is an initiative which must come from the United States to return to the Franklin Roosevelt standard of a fixed exchange rate system and a conversion of the world's financial obligations, that is the legitimate ones, forget the financial derivatives, the hedge funds. These things will simply be allowed to rot and be cast away and will not be paid. They cannot be paid. So they will not be paid because they cannot be paid. But the core of the system must be saved. And the only way to do that is if the United States says the dollar is now effectively as good as gold. This cannot be done in the short term. It can only be done on the basis of long-term agreements which cover treaty agreements lasting from a period of 25 to 50 years. There is no other hope for civilization. I shall come back to this again, but that's the crucial point here. Therefore, it is impossible to save this planet if President George Bush and Vice President Cheney remain in the leadership of the United States. Fortunately, there are conditions and indications that that will not last long. Now, I say this frankly, I say it without exaggeration, it must be said, and I am the most likely bloke, as they say, who will say it. The President of the United States, George W. Bush, is clinically insane. He is not only clinically insane, but he's clinically insane in ways which have rendered him technically impeachable. When the President of the United States, whose dollar is still the denominator of the world monetary system, says not once but repeatedly, and reasserts it defiantly against all criticism, that U.S. government bonds are merely IOUs which are intrinsically worthless, that man is clinically insane. He is irresponsible. Because if anybody believes in him, that the policy of the United States government is that its bonds are worthless, with the amount of dollar obligations outstanding around the world as an integral part of the monetary system, the system is doomed by that fact alone. Now, the United States Constitution provides for impeachment. The intrinsic basis for impeachment is not conviction of some crime. That is not sufficient basis for impeachment, because the question of the presidency of the United States is a question of an institution, not of a person. But if the person who occupies that institution is clinically insane or is otherwise incompetent to serve, that is sufficient grounds for a charge of impeachment and for his removal from office. On the other hand, we have a vice president who is not necessarily a psychopath, but is a sociopath. The man must be removed from office. What we have now, as a result of the actions and continuing actions of the Senate, we have a block being exerted by the U.S. Senate against the dangers intrinsic in the incumbency of these two creatures and the people who control them. And therefore, if the world is to be saved, these two creatures must be kept under control and removed from office, not 4 years or 3 years from now, but in the immediate future. Because we must immediately, in the near term, have a decision by the United States proffered to its partners internationally, which is essentially prevents a sudden chain reaction collapse of the world monetary system into not a depression, but a general breakdown crisis. A general breakdown crisis of the type which was discussed theoretically as a theoretical proposition at the beginning of the 19th century, and the beginning of the 20th, which has never happened before in modern history, but is about to happen now under present conditions. I continue. Unfortunately, the present U.S. Bush administration would prevent the needed action even with its dying breath. Fortunately, the present Bush administration is already a ruined, lame duck administration, a presidency whose deep psychological problems and brutish bunglings have already brought it into the liability of possibly early impeachment or retirement to avoid that impeachment. For example, one story that was told to us is there might be a plane ride, and on the plane ride, somebody might be sitting next to George W. Bush, or Cheney, rather. And when they got off the plane, Cheney would go someplace nearby and submit his resignation from office. We're in that kind of area in which either forced impeachment proceedings, or resignations, induced resignations, are maybe a factor in history. Under those conditions, much-needed options for the U.S. and for the world are now within the range of possibility, if by no means certainty. To understand the summary points I've just listed, there are four pivotal features of the immediate situation of the world today to be considered. First, the implications of little understood fact, even among leading European governmental circles today, that a coup d'etat in the USA itself was recently averted, at least temporarily, by a crucial intervention by a majority of the U.S. Senate. Second, the inevitability of a rather immediate permanent collapse of the present post-1971 form of world monetary financial system. This is the combined outcome of several crucial factors. A, the 1964-72 change, begun by an attack on the stability of the monetary system by the UK's first Harold Wilson government, was from the fixed exchange rate to a floating exchange rate system. B, a cultural paradigm shift toward a so-called post-industrial model in Europe and North America. C, a savage and willful destruction of basic European economic infrastructure throughout the Americas and also Europe. D, an increasing shift of production from economically developed nations to exploitation of cheap labor with vastly underdeveloped basic economic infrastructure and emphasis on very cheap labor. And E, reliance upon the use of a purely parasitical form of gambler's side bets known as financial derivatives or hedge funds, as a hyperinflationary substitute for long-term investment in useful enterprise. Third, although the present form of world monetary financial system is now hopelessly and rather immediately doomed, more doomed than the Soviet Union ever was, a physical economic form of recovery of the world economy could be launched very soon, provided the will is found for the immediate adoption of the model of the system of perfectly sovereign nation states projected by President Franklin Roosevelt before his death. And avoiding the present lemming-like rush into the form of global imperialism called globalization is soon eradicated and immediately reversed. Finally, the implied lesson to be learned from recent developments within the U.S. Senate is that unless the latter condition is met soon, the prospect for civilization in every part of the world is hopeless for more than a generation to come. That lesson is composed of the following four crucial subsume points, which I develop now. The crucial thing that we face in discussions in Europe is Europeans do not understand the United States. And therefore, when they talk about the United States, they make assumptions which are contrary to fact and are counterproductive. The United States is a product of Europe. It is particularly a product of the Renaissance, of the 15th century Renaissance, which established the modern nation state for the first time on this planet, for the first time we know of it on this planet. And through the development of the first modern nation states as such, in Louis XI's France, and then subsequently in Henry VII's England. But in the meantime, what had happened was that the Venetian interests, which had come back through the conquest of Constantinople, through turning it over to the Ottomans, had come back as a force. And so since that time, since about 1453, there has been a division in the world, and particularly on Eurasia, between, on the one hand, the emergence of the modern nation-state, which is committed to the service of all of the people of a nation, and the return to the medieval form of society, run originally by the Venetian banking system, and today expressed as a continuation of the Venetian banking system in the form of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system of economy, which dominates the world today. The imperialist system, in short, the modern imperialist system. Now, because of the rise of the Anglo-Dutch liberal tyranny, which was accomplished chiefly through the wars of Louis XIV in France and the subsequent 7 Years' War in Europe, Europe cannibalized itself, to the continental Europe, to the greater glory of Britain and the Netherlands. As a result, by 1763, through the mutual internal weakening of Europe, the Anglo-Dutch India companies had managed to carve out a de facto empire of India, and by taking over Canada in particular from the French. So at that point, in February 1763, at the Treaty of Paris, a new empire was formed, the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. The Anglo-Dutch liberal system was based on a system of financier control of the world economy, a continuation of the medieval system, the medieval ultramontane system, such that in Europe today, there is no independent government of any nation, because every government, each and every government, is a subject of a private central banking system. These central banking systems are like a biological slime mold. They are composed on the one side of individual banking interests, private banking interests, and on the other side, they are a continuous functioning process. So what we call is the world financial system today, the international monetary system since 1971-72, is a slime mold called an independent central banking system, or a syndicate of independent central banking systems. It was for precisely this reason that the United States came into being as a result of this treaty organization of February 1763. The foundations of the United States had been laid from Europe by people in the Netherlands, who at that time were democratically inclined, unlike the present ones, and who formed out of the Belgium, out of the Low Countries, formed part with the English, the first colony in New England, the so-called Plymouth colony. That was followed in 1630 by the formation of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which is actually the paradigm on which the United States was subsequently founded. This paradigm continued to be authoritative in its own territory until about 1688-89, when a change in the Dutch takeover, the Dutch India Company's takeover of England, resulted in a condition in which the powers of the Massachusetts Bay Company were reduced. But the struggle went on. And so in 1763, with the establishment of the British Empire, all of the leading circles, intellectual circles of Europe, began to look across the Atlantic again toward the possibility of creating a state in the Americas, particularly in North America, which could then be played back as a model as a struggle for the freedom of Europe from this Anglo-Dutch pestilence, this slime mold. The establishment of the United States as a republic, as a constitutional republic, gave us the opportunity for that. The attempts in 1789 in France in the spring were an attempt to form a constitutional republic, a monarchical republic in France, which would have had the same essential principles of development as the United States. Because of the British East India Company's power, that of Lord Shelburne, an organization called the Martinists, associated with Voltaire, including the Duke of Orleans, and Jacques Necker, who were two British agents, organized the Bastille events of July 1789, and then went on with two agents of the British East India Company, Danton and Morin, assigned from London to France, and then the Robespierre crowd, the Terror, which is also run from London. And then through the same instrumentality of Joseph de Maistre, you had a Jacobin terrorist called Napoleon Bonaparte was converted into an emperor on a model designed by Joseph de Maistre. And Napoleon ruined Europe. So the French Revolution, through Napoleon's 1815, subjected all Europe to ruin. And since that time, despite noble efforts like that briefly of President de Gaulle, for example, in his formation of the Heavy Front, Europe has never had a true republic in the sense that the United States is a republic. And so, therefore, the intention that the United States' formation as a republic should become the pioneer of a European model state to be utilized as a model back in Europe was never fully realized, except through people like Friedrich List and others who kept making the attempt to do that. And I'll return to some other aspect of this thing. But the point is this. The modern nation-state formed for the first time in the 15th century in Europe, in what is called the Golden Renaissance, established the principle, which is an old principle of European civilization, called the principle of the general welfare, which is known in the ancient Greek as agape, as set forth from the mouth of Socrates in the Republic. So this principle of the general welfare of common good, that the state has no right to exist except as it serves the common good and the general welfare of all of the people, was an old idea which first came to attention in ancient Greece, was adopted by Paul in the 1 Corinthians 13 as a principle of Christianity, an articulated principle of Christianity. And thus the aspiration of European civilization since that time since the time of actually Solon of Athens and so forth, has been the formation of a state committed to the common good, the general welfare of the total population, the present and future alike. The United States Constitution is formed on the basis of this principle. The highest constitutional authority under the U.S. Constitution lies in the preamble, whose central feature is promotion of the general welfare. Now, you find the same principle expressed in other places in European constitutions, but not as the overriding principle. You find that, for example, in the German Constitution, the German Grundgesetz. But it is not the controlling principle. It is not the principle which is fundamentally overriding. You find in the United States this principle is in jeopardy. It's opposed by the Lockean principle, which was the principle of the Confederacy. But this is the principle of the United States. Now, the difference is this. The difference is that people have the idea of economic systems based on conventional notions of money. This is a characteristic of European systems generally. Under the U.S. system, under the U.S. Constitution, money has no intrinsic value. The state determines what the value of money shall be. under the constitutional principle of the general welfare. How do we do this? Well, first of all, as I shall indicate here today, first of all, in a modern economy, unlike the economies of Asia today, even the best models of Asian economies today, in the best economies of Europe and the United States, the best models, 50% of the total economic activity of a nation is in basic economic infrastructure. 50% of the total investment and expenditure combined are expressed in the maintenance and improvement of basic economic infrastructure. Now contrast that with the situation in Asian countries, in which you have up to 70% or more of the population of those countries, even in the better countries, the countries which are stronger, 70% are living in states of distress, of extreme poverty. How is this done? It's done through partly through globalization. During the 1960s and beyond, we moved to begin moving production out of Europe and out of the United States and similar locations into poorer countries in search of cheaper labor, to transfer production from high labor cost areas to low labor cost areas. Now, the productivity of European countries, take the case of Germany, where we're standing here, post-war Germany, was rebuilt essentially under the influence of policies such as the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau. Now, Germany was a high-technology country with a heavy emphasis on basic economic infrastructure. Since modern Germany was created by Bismarck in 1877 on the U.S. model, which is sometimes called the Listian model, but was instigated by the leading world's leading economist of that time, the United States, Henry C. Carey. And since a similar thing was done in Japan, a similar attempt was made in Russia by Alexander II and under the direction of Mendeleev, and so forth and so on. Modern European economies have always tended in that direction, to recognize that the primary function of the state is to defend the economy of the nation and to provide, first of all, for the basic economic infrastructure as a part of maintaining the general welfare interest of all of the people in an equitable fashion. Now, this costs money. 50% of the United States expenditure as a nation, that is the physical economic expenditure, under times of prosperity, is spent on basic economic infrastructure. Much of this is done by the federal government. It is done in part by the state governments, in some degree by municipalities. It is done sometimes under regulation by private investors who invest in power works, power systems, and things like that, which are protected and managed by the state, but private investors can put their savings into these areas of guarantee low speculation. But it means that taking the economy as a whole, half of the total cost of the economy, of a healthy economy today, is spent on basic economic infrastructure. I should come back to this from the standpoint of Vanatsky to explain how this thing works. What we've done with globalization, with outsourcing and globalization, we go into countries and say we will export employment into your countries. We will export industry into your countries. We'll buy from your countries on the basis that you do not increase your expenditure on basic economic infrastructure. So therefore, the tendency is to impoverish the people of India, to impoverish the majority of the people of China, as a condition for getting the benefit of the U.S. and European market. There are physical reasons for this, explained by Mendeleev, or rather by Vanatsky. existence on the planet as a whole is a physical question. It's a physical scientific question. It's not a monetary question. When you want to discuss economics, get the accountants out of the room. Get rid of them. Get the financiers out of the room. Get rid of them. They will only make noises that will interrupt the discussion. Go back to physical economy. And look at it from the standpoint of Mendeleev. This planet has, according to Vinansky, has, according to him, three phases of existence. First is from an experimental standpoint, from the standpoint of scientific experiment, physical experiments. The first level are what we call abiotic processes, systems in which there is no calculated function of the role of life in the effect we're considering. The ordinary level. Now, this does not mean that the universe exists without life. It exists from the standpoint of experimental work, that in conducting scientific experiments, you define a phase space in which your proof of principle does not depend upon the assumption of the existence of a principle called life. And you restrict that kind of physical science to those kinds of experimental methods. Okay? Then you come to a second area, which was explored heavily by Pasteur, Curie, and so forth in France, which is the question of the kinds of experiments which define life and cannot be explained in any way but accepting the idea of a universal principle of life. This is what Vinansky defines as the biosphere, and he defines it from a standpoint of experimental methods. In the study of fossils, the relationship between living processes and their fossils. The third layer is that you have certain phenomena of this planet which are now manifest on a very large scale with the development of modern science and technology, in which the fossils of the planet, the functionally important fossils of the planet, are largely products of human intelligence, which are not otherwise generated by living processes, but only by the creative powers of human intelligence. Eh? Now, this is what a society is. A society is essentially the action of human intelligence among a people upon an area which we define as the biosphere. The biosphere is an area which includes what we define experimentally as non-living processes and their products, and then also living processes and their fossil products. Now, we as human beings, as society, we act upon a planet in which the preconditions of human life are possible because of the development of the planet, the development of life on the planet, the development of the fossils created by life on this planet. We then act upon this. We don't act as monkeys do. Monkeys make no inventions. They may pull tricks, like some of our politicians do, but they don't actually make useful inventions. So therefore, when we're talking about production, there are two ideas of production. And in European history, they're defined very clearly by the principle of Aeschylus' famous tragedy, Prometheus Bound. That Prometheus is sentenced to eternal torture because he gave knowledge of the use of fire to mankind. This is characteristic of society, of oligarchical society. We say we don't want the people to come up with ideas. We don't want them to become scientific. We don't want them to learn scientific principles. We want them to be used as Canet proposed and Turgot proposed in France, as the doctrine of the physocratic doctrine, that human beings are nothing but cattle, human cattle on estates, raised to be raised like cattle for the benefit of the profits of the Lord of the estate. That is the traditional manner of ancient society, is to treat the great majority of society either as hunted or herded cattle, to be used for the convenience of a small group of people who exploit them. Whereas in reality, human beings all human beings are potentially creative if developed. And all human beings can be fruitful if they're given the conditions of life in which to be fruitful. And the thing we prize about the human being is not their ability to behave as told, but their ability to behave in a way contrary to what they've been told. To make useful inventions which change society for the better. And we organize society to promote those changes. We define people as obliged not to obey rules as such, but to accept common tasks, common purposes, and to cooperate in common purposes. But the factor of cooperation always includes emphasis on promoting the education and development of the creative powers of the individual. And reshaping production, reshaping the conditions of life, to provide the greater opportunity for those individuals who wish to make a creative contribution to humanity as a whole. So what did we do with globalization? We took the United States, we took Europe, we started in Britain, first of all. Everything bad usually starts in Britain. They're very good at inventing this sort of thing. It's their contribution to history, is to invent bad ideas. So we started with the process of exporting national production into areas where we could exploit cheap labor without paying for the infrastructure needed to support those populations. We then did this to the United States, and we found areas where we prohibited these countries from developing their basic economic infrastructure, as we have done in Mexico, as we have done in South America, and has been done on a grand scale in Africa by aid of genocide. We did the same thing in Asia. The tsunami crisis showed exactly what happened. People died on beaches. Why? Because the U.S. policy and the European policy was there should be resorts, hotels and resorts, recreational centers, but no development. Development would be listed to entertainment for foreign guests who could use the bodies of the indigenous population for sexual recreation and similar kinds of things. So you had congregations of people living along beaches where the hotels were there for people who wanted sex or swimming. So they were living in shacks there. When this thing hit, there was no infrastructure to protect them. They were living under unsafe conditions, which were dictated by economic policy of institutions such as the Asia Pacific Foundation, which is an Anglo-American controlled institution. Typical. We have not developed the infrastructure of this part of the world, which is the key part of the world, the future of the world, the greatest concentration of population. China, North Asia, India, South Asia, Southeast Asia, this is the center of growth of the world's population. What you do to this area, you're doing to the world as a whole. We prohibit these areas as much as possible by various tricks and by miseducation from developing the basic economic infrastructure. The result has been we have taken the highest level of productivity in the world, physical productivity, which is concentrated in Europe and in the United States. We shifted the production from the United States and Europe into countries where cheap labor did the work instead. Cheap labor without much infrastructure, at least for the majority of the population. As a result of that, we earn less in the United States. The British are a perfect example of a self-inflicted disaster. We did the same thing in Europe. So therefore, we destroyed infrastructure, and we are destroying infrastructure in the United States and Europe. As a basis of this, we are shipping production into parts of the world where there is no significant infrastructure or not adequate infrastructure to maintain the population as a whole. The result is we have lowered the world's productivity per capita, because it is the relationship of production to infrastructure which determines physical productivity. And that's what we've done. Therefore, we have, by globalization, by eliminating protectionism, So that if one nation wanted to make a mistake, it didn't necessarily affect the other nation directly. By eliminating that protection of national sovereignty, we've created a situation where any disease, of an economic disease, is a global fatal epidemic. So the collapse of any significant part of the world today is a collapse of the world as a whole. Just think of it. What happens to countries like India and China if their export markets collapse in the United States and Europe? And they're about to collapse right now. The United States cannot carry this debt. It's developing now. It can't do that. United States purchases will collapse, even if it means killing people in the United States by starvation. Healthcare is collapsing. Healthcare institutions are collapsing worldwide. Vulnerability to epidemics is greatly increasing as a result of these things. So what we did is, by going into a what's called a free market economy, by going into a purely British model economy, by using economies which are based on the Venetian model of governments which are ruled over in their economic policy by independent so-called central banking systems. Europe has no sovereignty today. No nation in Europe is sovereign. They are all subject to independent central banking systems. Independent central banking systems are slime molds. They are parasites sucking on the blood of the entire nation. Governments which attempt to fight these slime molds are overthrown by one means or the other, as we're seeing in Europe today. So therefore, the United States is crucial in this respect. The United States is crucial because we have an economic system which is not the so-called capitalist system. The United States is not a capitalist economy. The United States is a system based on what's called the American system of political economy, which was created in opposition to Anglo-Dutch liberalism. The European models are capitalist economies. They're based on Anglo-Dutch liberalism. The only time that European economies were not capitalist economies is when, as with Bismarck's case, is when Bismarck realized from the lessons of the American success 1863 to 1876, recognized that Germany had to go to an industrial model. What happened? Not only did you have people like Emil Rathenau and Siemens and so forth launching the great industrial development of Germany, but you had the general welfare laws in Germany, which were the so-called Bismarck reforms, which were set up to do what? To provide protection for the general population in such ways that you could have a highly productive general population. The same thing was attempted in Russia by Alexander II, the Tsar, who was a friend of the United States and who was obviously eliminated by the British at the first opportunity. Like Alexander III, the same thing. But Russia, under the influence of Mendeleev's guidance and the adoption of the policies of the American system by Graf Witte, was a successful industrial developing population. The same thing, the Sun Yat-sen's conception of a new China were based on the same principles, which the China since Deng Xiaoping has been moving in that direction, trying to do that again today, as with the development of a railroad system for the internal infrastructure of China. So we have to go to a different kind of model, the model in which we, instead of having a Hobbesian rivalry among nations, we recognize that the nation state, a sovereign nation state, is an essential medium of self-government of a people. They manage their own affairs. They manage it because they share a common culture. They can share ideas in that culture. They are not cattle who take orders. They have a language. They have a cultural tradition. They think in terms of that language, that cultural tradition, developing that language, developing that cultural tradition. But we all have a common purpose if we are human. We're all human beings. This planet and the future of humanity is our common concern. But we know from experience that the best way to do that is through separate sovereign nations, which whose purpose is not to compete except in ideas and in practice, but whose purpose is to benefit one another. The same principle of agape, the same principle of the founding of the modern nation state, is expressed in the Treaty of Westphalia. What's the first paragraph, the first sentence of the Treaty of Westphalia? It's the principle of agape. The existence of the people and the nation is to care primarily for the other, improve the condition of the other. So a system of nation states which cooperates with the idea of mutual assistance for the development of the other sovereign people is the idea which is needed. The United States represents that tradition. It is presently the only part of the planet which has a constitutional form of government which actively represents that tradition. And what we must do, since we have responsibility, result of Franklin Roosevelt's work, we have the responsibility for an orderly international financial monetary system for the world as a whole. We can't force it on people, but we must offer it and we must protect it for their benefit. We must form associations for that purpose. Roosevelt's intention was to use the United Nations as a vehicle for that kind of cooperation. Truman and Churchill had a different idea. They used it to start a world war. But that idea is valid. We set up institutions such as the IMF, the original Bretton Woods system, and the World Bank, to fulfill these purposes. These institutions have now been corrupted and serve purposes directly contrary to the original intention of Franklin Roosevelt's government. The world as a whole, if it faces reality, knows we need these reforms. We need to return to the Franklin Roosevelt perspective, or what it was his perspective, until the moment he died. The kind of world he intended that we should build. Whereas Churchill and Truman and the rest of them went in a different direction, which we're still suffering from. And therefore, we in the United States have a special moral responsibility to recognize that under our system of government, banking systems and trade do not determine prices. Governments do. We determine protected levels of prices in order to maintain levels of investment and basic economic infrastructure and improvement in industry. We do that. It is our voluntary responsibility. We create a structure of prices. We do not allow a market to interfere with our management of our economies. The idea of the market is a Venetian idea. It's an evil idea. We must eradicate the idea of the market, the way the Venetian defines it, from our system, and go back to a protectionist system under which the government recognizes that 50% at least of the total expenditure of a government depends upon the general welfare as associated with infrastructure. We must promote scientific and technological progress, not the insanity which has taken over since the Greenies were born. And that's our problem. Now we've come to the point that for over 40 years, we have been making mistakes. The mistake is largely the result of the Churchill-Truman agreement at the end of the last war, to go to a world war as a way of preventing Roosevelt's system from working. We have to create the same intention that existed then. We've lived under a mistake. We have come to accept habits and ways of thinking which are a mistake. We say experience teaches us. Experience has made us fools because we were not smart enough to outwit experience, to recognize when experience was wrong. And therefore, in the United States, we have this responsibility. We have a constitution which still functions. You have a Senate which is not a parliamentary institution. And that's where Europeans are wrong. They don't understand the U.S. government. The Senate is not a parliamentary institution. It never goes out of existence. Every European parliament goes out of existence at every election. The U.S. government never goes out of existence. The Senate remains in existence. The president changes. The federal institutions remain in existence. The elections occur. The Senate remains without any break in continuity. One-third of the Senate is changed every 2 years. But the Senate as a whole maintained. The Senate is given powers under the Constitution. We created the most powerful kind of presidency as an institution the planet knows. It's the most efficient presidential institution on the planet. But in creating a powerful institution, we recognized the danger that such an institution could be used by evil forces. Therefore, we built into our system certain checks and balances, including special powers of the Senate. These powers of the Senate are the power of a minority of the senators to oppose the federal government, the executive branch, on crucial issues of government. What the George Bush administration attempted to do, under orders from George Pratt, Schultz, and people like that, was to break that power of advice and consent of the Senate to take advantage of the fact that you had a majority of Republican Party members in both the House and Senate in order to impose by will whatever the White House or its masters dictated. If that had not been done, if that had not been defeated, you would have nuclear wars around the world already today, such as the question of North Korea. Cheney and company and the people behind him were ready to start dropping nuclear weapons on mountain areas in North Korea. They zealously desired to do it. They had similar kinds of ideas. The Senate's action took that power away from them. And now what is happening is the power of the presidency is diminished, of this presidency is diminished, as the president, as the senators stand up on their hind legs, having proven their power as a body, as a bipartisan body, and are beginning to move to defend pension systems against rape. They're defending the pension systems against General Motors Corporation, to defend the Social Security system. And they will defend other things now. They will call into question more than ever before this Iraq war. They will call into question the Iraq war policy in general. Because the United States is now, through the Senate, becoming the United States once again. Like a phoenix, is inherent in the system, and we've now saved it. If nothing goes wrong, if we continue our course of action, we can save the planet. If we don't do this, the planet won't exist, at least in a decent form. Therefore, we have no choice but to form certain policies. People will often oppose policies by raising objections to them. But on the battlefield, in decisive wars, you don't raise such objections. You don't raise an objection to the policy which determines the life or death of a nation. We now have policies not in the military domain, but in the political domain, the economic domain. These policy changes will determine the life or death of world civilization. We have to eliminate the environmentalist movement as a force in politics. We have to eliminate globalization. We have to eliminate the related provisions of the World Trade Organization. These things must be eliminated. Whether this is popular or not is irrelevant. We have the choice, either we make these changes or we go down. You have no choice unless you choose to lose the war. Thank you.
Danke, Lynn. So we will now go into a discussion on what Mr. LaRouche just has outlined. I would ask for your questions and comments, which please should not exceed 5 minutes. We have approximately at least 1 hour for the discussion. So please, questions, comments. Yeah. So for the questions, please go to this microphone.
And please identify yourself.
Yeah. I'm Nino Galloni. I have a question to Lyndon, for Lyndon, about Iran, new situation, and Europe. Iran, what? Perhaps the
Iranian, your assessment of the Iranian situation was the new president.
Oh, and you
is good. The question is how the recent Iranian election results can change, worsening, I mean, the Middle East situation. Could the new, not new at all, of course, back to United States-Europe relationship to a kind of so-called Cold War? In Italy and in Europe, many people are talking about Europe without England. The financial criteria of Maastricht are inadequate to economical situation. But the alternative is to build Europe or to come back to the monetary and economical national sovereignty of each country. This is the question is about the relationship between the new Iran situation and the role the Europe can play into the international Middle East theater.
Okay. All right. First of all, we have in Iran. You have the usual thing. Remember that if you know history, that the British East India Company, once it had established its imperial power in 1763, set up what became the India Office, and they created things which became such as the Muslim Brotherhood and other institutions in Central Asia and elsewhere. They began to manage extensively the Middle East, so-called, as a part of this process. They introduced cults. Now, the British were very thorough. They would have visiting scholars and other kinds of creatures, missionaries and whatnot, going into every village and finding out what families are important and influential in the villages. They would set up a card index on the entire population in depth of these countries. And they would go back from London or from places where the British were deployed, go back into these areas and maintain their contact with these family groups and so forth. So what they did is they established a map of influence in this area. Now you get, for example, you had the British and the United States went into a policy which was launched officially by the Trilateral Commission under Brzezinski in the middle of the 1970s. It was became known as the Afghan War Policy. And what they did is they recruited people from the Islamic world to go in and fight Great Satan, i.e. the Soviet Union, in Afghanistan. The objective, as Brzezinski put it at the time, when he was head of the Trilateral Commission and was becoming the National Security Advisor, he organized at the same time a revival of what was called the Committee on the Present Danger. Now, the Committee on the Present Danger was first created in the late 1940s, as the committee to promote a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. The same kind of a thing was done under Brzezinski with the Committee on the Present Danger, which I exposed publicly in 1976. In a famous broadcast, which caused quite some furor in Italy, among other places, where I had this five-minute segment, which is also shown in Italy. And as a part of that, this was part of an operation for a general flanking assault against the Soviet Union. But it was more than that. That operation continues to the present day. You see it in Afghanistan. You see it in Transcaucasia. You see it in Chechnya, in particular. You see it in Ukraine. You see it threatened in Kazakhstan, which is a very dangerous kind of thing. Now, what they did is used contexts, as you right now, for example, the United States Bush administration tried to utilize some of these assets from Bush 1 in Kyrgyzstan to establish a coup in Kyrgyzstan against the regime, whose target was also Xinjiang, because this crowd was also targeting China. And Xinjiang is one of the targets. And the Kyrgyzstan operation was targeting that direction. Well, various people acted, and this thing did not get out of control in Kyrgyzstan. But then, when the United States backed off from pushing this policy at this time, precisely because the United States was embarrassed, it did not have the resources to start extending wars in new areas under present conditions, then the British stepped in Uzbekistan, also using veterans of the Brzezinski Wars in Afghanistan, the drug lords, which have been used in Kyrgyzstan, southern Kyrgyzstan, are now used in Uzbekistan and are being used in other parts of the region. So what happens, therefore, is the British have a fingertip control over networks they can influence in various parts of Asia. They have a control which overall is more sensitive and much more in-depth than the United States intelligence services. The British intelligence services have the longest-lasting, in-depth penetration of these parts of the world. So, therefore, you have Rafsanjani, who is trying to manage his role in Iran to deal with a very complicated situation throughout Southwest Asia as a whole, as well as with the United States, with a very difficult United States to deal with the George Bush administration. And therefore you find that certain things that are possible, which are typified by the use of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is still a British intelligence operation, are used in these parts of the world to cause destabilizations. The Muslim Brotherhood almost never comes to power, but it often destroys a government and creates the basis for a change in government, as they tried to do in Egypt, or they intended to do in Egypt recently again. So this is the nature of the problem. What we have to do is somehow realize we need a Europe of sovereign nations. We do need regional agreements. But we were working toward regional agreements within Europe beforehand. What has destroyed this was the way that the reunification of Germany was handled and the treatment of the states of Eastern Europe. The states of Eastern Europe, as in East Germany, are worse off today than they were under the Soviets, of Soviet influence. Employment conditions, economic conditions, prospects for the future are worse. So what we have done in all of Western Europe, we have taken the advantage of the collapse of the Soviet Union to ruin Western Europe, and while ruining for the former Soviet Union in an elegant fashion, the same way. So what we need to do is realize that to recognize, first of all, that these were crimes, not just mistakes, they were crimes. And we now try to rationalize crimes as being, well, it's historic. You can't put the beer back in the bottle, that sort of thing. So we had ideas which existed beforehand, ideas of a peaceful Europe, ideas which were optimistic ideas of 1789 on the fall of the wall, the idea that now we would be free, that the old conflict would now be over, we could now work with Russia, we could work with these other countries, we could jointly build these economies, and precisely the opposite was done. We've destroyed these areas. What we've done to Russia is a crime against humanity. What we've done to Eastern Europe is a crime against humanity. We turn people into agents of foreign influence. So what we simply have to do is go back to the nation state, go back to nation state currencies, because if a government does not control its currency, it doesn't control anything. If a government does not have sovereign authority above a central banking system, it doesn't control anything. We have a situation in which all central banking systems are now bankrupt, inherently bankrupt. Therefore, we have to take advantage of this situation to have the governments put the central banking systems into receivership, which means the agency of government which takes the central banking system into receivership for management now becomes a national banking system. This does not mean you eliminate private banks. It means that you put them under the supervision and coordination of a national banking system. Now you can create credit through a national banking system, which you can manage the flow of credit throughout the economy for necessary national purposes. So we have to go back to a nation-state system entirely, eliminate this idea of globalization, all these kinds of things, eliminate this World Trade Organization nonsense, go back to a sovereign nation-state system, and recognize that our basic enemy, which is the old Venetian enemy, which you in Italy understand very well. You know, understand the stiletto, which is the basic instrument of British intelligence, is the stiletto. So under these conditions, that's what we must do. We must reestablish the principle of the sovereign nation state, emphasize the importance of the sovereignty of the nation state above any central banking system. We have the opportunity and necessity of putting all central banking systems into bankruptcy receivership, which means you have to create a state institution to do that. Such a state institution is a national bank or a national banking institution, an authorized national bank of the government. The government bank then becomes the agency for coordinating among the various other banking institutions and similar kinds of institutions. Now you have a national policy. Now you can create credit if you have a fixed exchange rate system. You can now create credit on the basis of long-term, for long-term projects, and you can now calculate what level you can sustain long-term projects in such a way that 25 years from now, those projects will be sound. And that's what we need to do. Go back to the nation state. Go back to Nicholas Accusa. Go back to Florence.
Thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. I have a question to clarify the idea about the switching to the fixed exchange rate, just to mention now. The main problem will be with the American currency, of course. For Russia, it is not a problem because Russian monetary base is two times less than amount of currency reserves in the central bank. So the Russian central bank can offer any fixed exchange rate what it like. But if you look for the United States situation, we see that amount of dollars already created by the Federal Reserve System and together with the Treasury bonds is 25 times higher than amount of currency and gold reserves which the United States has now. Does it mean that in order to balance this, we should find opportunity to decrease monetary base of dollar more than 20 times? Does it mean that all dollar accounts should be frozen and changed to 25 years treasury bonds or something like that? If it happens so, I think dollar as a currency couldn't exist anymore. We should switch to some kind of new currency then.
Well, the question, this comes down to a question of productivity. What is the potential productivity of the United States over, say, 10 years ahead, 25 years ahead, under what conditions? Fortunately, we still have in the United States what is endangered right now by General Motors and Ford, that the greatest single concentration of machine tool capacity in the United States is concentrated in the auto industry. We also have it in the air industry, but that's largely in the military sector as such. So what we have to do is we will have to have a full mobilization of the United States for a rapid growth of production. Now this means that we're going to bankrupt a lot of things in the United States. For example, financial derivatives, all hedge funds, all financial derivatives are canceled. We've got bankrupt banks. The hedge funds are tied to the banks. The responsibility of the U.S. government is to prevent the banks from collapsing in a way which collapses the U.S. economy and world economy. Therefore, we put them in receivership. When we put them in receivership, we took the accounts, we say, hedge fund, doesn't exist. Gone. Now, that is the biggest part of the problem. Now, if we can then say, all right, U.S. bonds, we're going to create a new series of U.S. obligations, 25 and 50-year obligations, but 25-year denominations largely. We will then monetize in that form through bond issues, monetize the U.S. debt, and use that for development, world development. In other words, we will be making long-term credit assignments to various parts of the world for various kinds of projects with U.S. participation. We will use the monetized debt of the United States as a monetary medium for financing that. For example, Europe does not have the ability under its constitutions for that kind of operation. The United States is unique in our constitution specifies there's no authorization to produce money by anybody except by going to prison. Except by U.S. law, by federal law. The Europeans don't have that. Therefore, in Europe and Eurasia, you rely more on long-term treaty agreements. Though the United States can easily merge into, shall we say, a Eurasian complex of treaty agreements, long-term treaty agreements. We must convert much short-term obligations into long-term obligations. Otherwise, we can't manage them. So we do have to have a reorganization of currency and debt. That can be done, I think, by one monetary conference, because everybody needs it. Not because they want it, but because if we don't have it, we're going to have a total collapse of the entire system. The degree, and we know it in the U.S., in Washington and New York, when you talk about certain things, you get a hushed sigh in the room. Everyone goes silent because we all know it's true and no one wants to mention it except me and a few people who talk to me privately, but publicly never. The debt situation is horrific, but the situation of the world as a whole, the entire world is financially bankrupt right now, because you have, for example, China has assets, claims against the U.S. dollar. Those claims are essentially worthless. We have to make them worth something. Japan has tremendous claims against the U.S. dollar. We can't have those things going down. We have to protect them. We can only protect them by long-term trade agreements, long-term trade and development agreements, and which means a change in policy. It means that the prices will have to go up in many cases. Free trade will go out. Free trade will be essentially outlawed. We'll go to a protectionist system. Prices will change under protectionist rules. We're going to have to increase taxation rates. This low taxes for entrepreneurs is at an end. We'll go back to something like a policy that was done under Kennedy of the investment tax credit program. We will tax everyone high, but then we'll give them a credit if they invest their profits in things that we consider useful for the economy. So we're going to have to do that kind of thing on a global scale.
Maybe one more question for clarification. Does it mean that if a Federal Reserve System will do what you propose, does it mean that European Central Bank and Japanese should do the similar things?
What would happen, these Europeans will have to put their central banking systems into receivership, because I can assure you that every European country is bankrupt. Therefore, their central banks do not have any credibility. They only have a political credibility that every country needs national banking. Now, central banks have now taken over the function of national banking and have failed. But the country belongs to the people, not to the central banking system. Therefore, instead of the central banking system putting the people into bankruptcy, the people will put the central banking system into bankruptcy. We need the system, therefore we will create national banks. We create national banks by taking the bankrupt central banking systems into receivership. And they become part of the asset holding of the national banking system. In return, we prevent the banks from collapsing. For example, in Germany, we cannot have Deutsche Bank collapse. We just cannot have that. It can't be allowed. I don't care how bad the management is. We can't allow it. I would like to bring back Alfred Herrhausen alive. I think that would be a good option, but that's not possible.
Excuse me. Yuri Gromyko from Russia. Also, Lynn, thank you very much for your presentation. And question about American economical system and Vernadsky legacy. So the question is following. You said very important thing that American economical system is not capitalist economy. Yeah. But I know it doesn't mean for you automatically that this is socialist economy. Yeah. And also, what you said that government must protect the level of prices, it's known as element of socialist economy. But as I understood correctly, the main thing, it's capability of government not to be connected with the private interest immediately, but to produce long-term infrastructure projects and demonstrate that there is capability to realize such things. Because it's also clear about Central Asia, that in period of Soviet Union, when we have opportunity to produce such infrastructure project, less in Kyrgyzstan, but more in Uzbekistan, it was possible simply for people to live there. And just now there is disaster because, for example, in Kyrgyzstan, a huge unemployment, drug money trafficking, and such thing. So it means that real capability of American economical system is connected with possibility to produce in interest of the whole population long-term infrastructure project and to realize them.
Well, what I've done on this in this thing, which is why I've emphasized this, the Sanowski concept. The problem is that those of us who have proper education and experience can understand certain things that are not generally understood by even educated people. Therefore, you need a concept. It's like you have to have a concept of a scientific principle. You have to have a concept of it, which is a working concept. What we need is a way that people can understand. Now, what I did earlier was this question like the raw materials, on Vernadsky on raw materials. We have, Asia is coming up in population. The demands of the people of Asia for a higher standard of living and improvement is there. We take two cases, we take China and India as the two key cases which are policy determining in this area. We need raw materials, so-called. Well, that's the wrong way to define it. We need to know how we can generate what we call raw materials as we need them and guarantee these at fair prices to everyone who will have these needs. Therefore, we have to go back and say, why not have people understand the truth? Why have this stupid stuff that's taught in universities and similar places all over the place? Why not destroy the myth? Why not make it clear what humanity is? Make clear what we mean by the biosphere. Make clear what we mean by the noosphere. Make clear what economics is from those standpoints. And then define a concept of economy, a concept of physical economy. Forget monetary economy. If someone comes in with monetary theory, put them out of the room or put them under sedation. Because we want to get rid of monetary theory. There is no intelligence required for monetary theory, and the less intelligence you have, the more easily you can understand it. So therefore, what we need to do is have a science of society in which we understand why we create money, how we define prices. The market doesn't define prices. The problem with the socialist systems were such that they were based on this Marx's conception of this proletarian conception, which the worst of it was as Engels, but Marx was ambiguous. But Engels was a real British idiot. And therefore, we have to do human creative intelligence. The problem is that we have been subjected, since the rise of the new Venetians, to the empiricism of Paolo Sarpi. And Paolo Sarpi says that there are no such things as creative ideas in the universe. If they exist, they can't be known. They should be suppressed. We, from our standpoint, as from the standpoint of the Renaissance, from the standpoint of ancient classical Greece, it is the ability of the human mind to create valid discoveries of principle in art and science, which is what the distinction of the human species from the beast. And the what we've been taught is a beastly theory of human behavior without actual science, or with a science which is not science, mechanistic science, as opposed to dynamic science. Whereas Vernadsky represents a prototype deeply embedded in all of European civilization of true science. And I had this recent thing I just dug out from due to Vernadsky's son, had this translation which is stuck in the Columbia University Library, dated from 35-36, which exemplifies exactly how he thought. He thought in the tradition of Leibniz, not Descartes. And that's the problem. We have people who think in terms of Cartesian thinking. Marx was a victim of this. Marx was brainwashed by the British. He was sent to the British Library under the top British agent who ran him as part of this Young Europe operation. And he was brainwashed. So therefore what's passed down is you start with the cell form of exchange relations. Nonsense. You have to start from the standpoint of the relationship of society, the noosphere to the biosphere to the abiotic system. And now you find the function of the individual behavior within that. Now you have economy. And what's taught is the wrong way. So my view is the problem is one of the socialist was not well, the proletarian secretes wisdom. The ignorant people secrete wisdom. The problem in the Soviet system, the scientists were the lowest paid people. The most useful people, the ones who made the greatest contribution, were the most despised, the treated the most badly, except by behind the door. So therefore we have to put science and the idea of scientific creativity foremost, because it is scientific creativity which drives productivity, which drives and improves the productive conditions of life. And therefore my view is, let us eliminate this disease of called modern political economy. Eliminate this Venetian, British, Dutch system. Eliminate the liberal system and all the ideas and filth that goes with it. Let's go back to science. And the American system, as defined by such things as Hamilton's works as Treasury Secretary, define a scientific conception of economy. There is no lawful price. There is a price which the government determines by law, but no lawful price. The issue is not just prices. The issue is productivity. Productivity is increase in productive power. How do we make people more productive? How do we educate them better? How do we give them more productive potentiality? So let's take Vernadsky. Let's take the definition of the ratio of the abiotic domain and its fossils as ratio to the biosphere, and it, including its fossils, the noosphere and its fossils, and the rate of change among these things as determined by individual discovery and action. Get that focus, and then we don't have this problem. I mean, I know that there's, like our people in the in Moscow, in the museum, the Vernadsky Geological Museum, they have precisely the kinds of ideas, the kinds of thinking, and they know it. With this kind of thinking, we have to bring it to bear. We have to increase the productive powers of mankind per capita and per square kilometer at rates sufficient to meet the demands of growing world population. We look at the population of India, we look at the population of China, and we say, under this system, these demands cannot be met. Then I look at Indonesia, I look at the rest of Southeast Asia, I say, we are not prepared to meet the demands of the next generation of humanity. And therefore, we need to organize society around the ability to meet the demands of the coming generation. How do we do that? Vernadsky. Vernadsky is the school on which to organize around the great question of development of raw materials for the needs of all parts of this planet. And the American system approach to Vernadsky is perfect. We need economic science. We need to get rid of what is taught as economics in universities today.
Oui, Monsieur le Président, permettez-moi de mettre un peu d'ambiance en posant ma question en français. La première question, c'est que l'Amérique fait peur de plus en plus à tout le monde, y compris à l'ONU. quel rôle on doit donner aujourd'hui à l'ONU pour libérer cette institution de la mainmise de George Bush et de son gouvernement, parce que tout simplement les Américains sont les principaux bailleurs de fonds. Deuxième question, Monsieur le Président. Oui, allez-y.
Yes, Mr. President, allow me to put to introduce a new environment by talking with in French, and I want to ask you two questions. The first one is, what role do you view for the United States, for the United Nations? What role do you view for the United Nations at this point? The U.S. Creates fear throughout the world. The United States provokes fear throughout the whole world. What do you propose to change the role of the UN, since at this point the United States controls the UN? How to avoid this problem?
Well, the U.S. does not really control the UN. People have this myth about the United States. You live inside the United States, and you say, what controls the United States? What controls the United States is largely an Anglo-Dutch liberal system, which is centered in London, not in the United States. That's what controls it. Anyone who lives in the United States and who fights as I fought and finds the enemies I can tell you exactly who runs this operation. It's the Anglo-Dutch liberals from London. And right now, the biggest enemy Europe has, the biggest enemy I have, is the liberal imperialist Fabian regime of Tony Blair. He's the greatest threat to civilization existing on this planet at this moment. This is what the problem is. Now, the United Nations organization was created by Franklin Roosevelt with a very specific policy in mind. As Roosevelt told Churchill in Atlantic meetings and in North Africa and elsewhere, he said, the United States, at the end of this war, the United States is not going to allow the continuation of the British Empire in any form or guise. We're going to have an American system, not a British system. These countries are going to be freed. We are going to develop them. We're going to assist them in development. Now, the intention of Roosevelt specifically was, at the end of the war, all colonial power systems should be eliminated. Not only must we eliminate the colonial system, but we must create and develop independent governments where colonial systems existed. Churchill was red-faced and blue-faced over that issue. And as soon as Stalin was involved in it, China was involved in it, both sides factions of China, the Kuomintang and Mao Zedong, were both involved in these negotiations. The intent was, Indochina was at that point a darling of the United States during the war. And Indochina was going to become an independent nation under United States promotion at the end of the war. What happened, for example, is take the case of Indochina. The United States ordered, and the British ordered, under Truman, that the Japanese troops which had been quarantined in camps in Indochina were to pick up their guns and go out and reoccupy Indochina until the French could come in and take charge of the place, recolonize it. Indonesia, which had been largely self-independent of the Japanese during this period, was subjected to a war by invasion by Dutch forces of reconquest. India's independence was postponed by a year, and so forth and so on. So the idea of liberalizing the planet in the sense of freeing colonial peoples was eliminated. The idea of cooperation with Russia, with Soviet Union under Stalin, was eliminated. The Yalta Agreement was eliminated. And the reason for the Yalta Agreement, the reason for the discussions with Mao Zedong and with Chiang Kai-shek were exactly that. We're going to establish a post-war order under which nations which had been colonialized would be free. And the planet would be concerned to make that transformation from a system of colonial powers into a system of free nations, sovereign nation states. The United Nations was one institution which was created with the idea of a coordinating agency among a world of sovereign nation states. Huh? We created the IMF, the Bretton Woods system, which was a U.S. creation. The British had nothing to do with it except submit, and they couldn't resist it at the time. It was not Keynes. John Maynard Keynes had nothing to do with the formation of the IMF except to be kicked out of forming it. So the usual myth in Europe that John Maynard Keynes is the basis for the United Nations organization is crazy, or the basis for the Bretton Woods system is insane. There's no truth to it whatsoever. This was entirely United States. This was Franklin Roosevelt. And this was the American tradition. And Keynes was the disease. See, Keynes is the archetype of the idea of a central banking system. Keynes's theory. Keynes was a fascist. Keynes wrote his general theory and published it in Germany with praise to Hitler as the most appropriate situation for the implementation of his theories. And he was right. So anyway, so the Bretton Woods system and then the World Bank was the idea of having a special facility for assisting nations which did not have ordinary means of incurring debt for their development. So what's happened with Africa is that under the changes under Nixon and beyond, that Henry Kissinger and others devised policies such as National Security Study Memorandum 200, 1975. And this said that the raw materials of Africa belong to the United States. And the Africans are consuming too much of this raw material means. Now, Henry Kissinger left that particular post at that point as National Security Advisor, but the policy continued. It is in Africa today. Africa is being subjected to a policy of genocide conceived by the Anglo-Americans to prevent the African population from growing, in fact, to reduce the African population, to steal all the raw materials and prevent the Africans from using it, and to prevent any African nation from developing, because it will use more raw materials if it does. So what happens is the imperial conception is that the shield of Northern Asia, the raw material shield of Central and Northern Asia, belongs to the Anglo-Americans. The intent toward Russian policy is to steal that whole area and control it, and to blackmail China by controlling that area of raw materials. The same thing, the southern shield in Africa and the other resources of Africa, to steal them. We are running a policy of genocide against Africa deliberately by Anglo-Americans with some Israeli help. That's what's going on there, and some French complicity. Genocide. So the problem is not a lack of institutions which understand. The problem is one of deliberate malice. The policy comes from the Venetian policy, it comes from a Spanish policy, where Spain said that Africans from Southern Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa are not human. They're animals. And therefore you will herd them like animals. You will kill the old bulls, you'll get rid of the old women, and you'll take the young women and children, and you'll make slaves of them. And you slip the slaves around the world to various places like the Americas, and they shall be property forever. And so this idea of Africa, as expressed in the 1970s by Henry Kissinger and people of his mentality, is a policy of deliberate genocide against Africa, and that is the problem. It is not a lack of reforms, it's a lack of elimination of the genocidalist. And the Anglo-Americans are the worst.
Deuxième question, le nom de la France à la Constitution européenne, je pense, est une chance. Comment voyez-vous l'avenir maintenant de l'Europe après ce nom à la Constitution européenne?
Thank you very much. Mr. LaRouche, a second question. How do you view the no of France to the European Constitution? I think it is a chance for Europe, but how do you think things will evolve, will continue after this no?
I'm not too happy with France right now. The no, I thought was a very necessary thing, but I don't think the motives were necessarily good motives. I don't think the motives were positive ones. I think they were negative ones. But I was glad it happened. It's like the accident that happened to Hitler. I was glad it happened. The problem in Europe is that France does not have a reflection of one of its greatest recent moments, which I had the privilege of finding out about by a conversation with Jacques Rouef I had back in the middle of the 1970s, where at that time I was proposing a monetary reform. And I met with him with the purpose of discussing the question of monetary reform, as he was the author of the so-called heavy franc reform. He said, well, yes, you're right. This would work, but let me explain to you something. When I came up with a heavy franc as a proposal, everybody in France opposed me on it. And so Charles de Gaulle, the president, asked me, but everybody opposes your proposal. Why should I support you on this? He said, because I will stake my life's reputation of my life's work on the success of this proposal. And Charles de Gaulle, who was not an economist, responded, okay, we could do it. You don't have such leaders in Europe or in France in particular today. The absence of them is notable. And what is needed particularly is a driver for all of Western Europe, in particular Western continental Europe, as a partner, from my standpoint, as a partner of the United States in getting this kind of program going. Because strategically, to save the world, we have the following parameters. We have the development recently of, particularly as in its tentative adoption, first in 1998 under then Prime Minister Primakov, of the proposal for a triangle, a productive triangle in Asia, triangle, Russia, India, China. This is, in fact, the proper center of Eurasia today, this proposal, because the organization of relations between the productive centers of Western and Central Europe with those of the triangle, the Eurasian triangle countries, via Russia as such, is the key to the future successful development of Eurasia and is the central point of development of the world at large. Now, the progress in this direction is useful, but it is pitifully small relative to what is required. Asia is, and its populations are immensely large. We have populations where 70% of the population of China and India, which are key countries, is very poor, which means that we have to develop not merely employment, but infrastructure. Without development of infrastructure, you cannot really change the problem of India or the problem of China. Can't be done. And similarly through all of Southeast Asia. So therefore, the needs for long-term investment and long-term development in Asia is enormous. This cannot be done without a large development of Russia and Kazakhstan, because the greatest concentration of mineral resources, on land-based mineral resources, is in those areas. And you cannot simply rape areas. You have to get in there and develop the areas in order to get the raw materials developed. Therefore, you have to have a Western Central Europe, Russia, India, China pivot for Eurasia. Without a very large growth in this area, a high rate of growth, there is no future for humanity. Now, what part of Europe is best qualified to take the intellectual leadership practically in this direction? It's Germany. Germany has a vast underemployment, a labor force, a wasted labor force. They're all talking about it. You're talking about up to 10 million unemployed. Germany also has a structure in its economy based on the precedent of the Kreditanstalt of Wiederaufbau, where Germany has shown itself the most efficient nation in Europe for use of long-term and medium-term credit for successful rapid expansion of an economy. So therefore, in the kind of German banking system, which almost went out of existence after the execution of Herrhausen, in that kind, and Rohwedder, that this aspect of German culture, still today, despite vast unemployment, is the most efficient mechanism for organizing collaboration in Western and Central Europe with Russia and with Asia generally. So therefore, that is the perspective we should be looking at. That's where you should be going. And if we can do that with U.S. cooperation, with this kind of Eurasian orientation, then we have an approach to deal with the world as a whole. We don't have the resources to solve the problem of Africa right now. But if we do that, we will have the resources to solve the problem of Africa. We can solve the problem of South America. That we can do. There's enough structure left over there that we can actually, with cooperation of these nations, we can bring them back and bring ourselves back at the same time. But this cooperation of the United States and the Americas with the Eurasian cooperation is the way in which to look at the future of the world for the next 50 years to come.
Are there further questions to Mr. LaRouche directly? If not, Professor Zeling.
Mohamed Selim from Egypt. Thank you for a very illuminating presentation. I have a comment and a question. A comment concerning what you mentioned about building touristic resorts on the beaches in Southeast Asia. This is true, and the same thing happened in Egypt. I figured out when you were talking about Egypt, as a matter of fact. The same story, we spent billions of dollars building touristic resources on the northern coast and on the Red Sea coast instead of building houses for the poor or the middle class. As a matter of fact, estimated something like $25 billion were invested in building these resorts, which are used only for 2 months a year, in July and August. And the rest of the year, they are vacant. Nobody is using them. So we wasted tremendous and valuable resources building them at the expense of building the projected, at this time, nuclear reactors, which were supposed to be built on the northern coast and on the Red Sea coast to generate electricity and to desalinate water, because Egypt suffers from a shortage of water. And these projects were cancelled under American pressure. The Americans came to President Sadat and said, disband of these projects and build these resorts, which are, so we wasted. And as a matter of fact, this process is still going on. We still have one other area to the west of Marsa Matruh, which has been sold now to the Italians in order to build other resorts using the same money and wasting the same resources. So as I subscribe to what you said, that this was a process of looting national resources to the benefit of the rich and at the expense of the poor. Now, I want to ask a question, Mr. LaRouche, concerning your perception of the role of governments, that the government must manage the economy. This is okay, but what are the limits of the role of governments in managing the economy? When you were talking about this, I have in mind the old Soviet model of the government owning everything, the present Chinese model of mixed economy. The government is owning and encouraging the private sector. And I have also the Korean or the Japanese model of the government is not owning but encouraging and supervising the private sector. So to which model do you subscribe here? Because I want to have a clear idea about, because there is a lot of talk about governments also could be mismanaging the economy, government corruption as well. So how do we solve this problem? I also noticed that the notion of the element of politics is not clear in this process. Governments also must be monitored by the people. The element of participatory democracy is also crucial. If governments are to implement that managing role, I subscribe to your idea of the essential role of the state, of the sovereignty of the state, of the equality of the states in the global system. But what are the limits of this, and what is the political dimension of this process in your judgment? Thank you very much.
Well, the first thing, the Great American Experiment, which was the foundation of the United States, was a expression of all history, because of European civilization. It started essentially with the time of Solon and the Pythagoreans and so forth, in which came from Egypt, by the way, which should always be borne in mind, that the civilization of Europe was founded on the basis of the influence of Egypt on the Pythagoreans and similar people. And the great pyramids at Giza attest to the sources of this knowledge and understanding. So one always speak with respect of Egypt when one comes from a European civilization for that reason. Moses came out of there, by the way, so that also settles a few questions. The problem here is if you reduce a large part of the population to something tantamount socially, politically, or even just economically to human cattle, which has been, of course, the problem in Egypt. You have a complex problem of trying to have equitable behavior by government. If you don't have economic growth, for example, the 1982 effort to establish the improvement of the new cities in Egypt, the irrigated new agro-industrial complexes, of moving population out of over-congested Cairo, which is impossible to maintain, and Alexandria, impossible to maintain, and to move the population into areas which were cleaner and more economically maintained and self-maintained. So that it's the degree to which the population itself is brought into the political process, not as an opposition, not as beggars, not as... because that otherwise you have a situation where a member of government or a group of members of government have family interests among the poor or among businessmen. And this will tailor the way in which they behave in terms of the behavior of government. If you have a more actively participating population, which is confident of its rights as a people and has a moral sense of its efficiency in getting government to behave itself, then you have good government. But you don't have good government if you have a large number of people who are alienated from the processes of government. And therefore, the promotion of productivity of government, the promotion of education of people, is crucial in this matter, which is our experience. We found that many of our troubles came from, for example, in the southern states where slavery existed. Slavery not only deprived and oppressed the slave, it corrupted the people who lived in the society next to the slave because they accepted it. If you accept the person living next to you as being treated as an animal, you lose your own humanity. In other words, you have to set a moral standard about how you view your relation with the people around you. And the problem in these societies is they tend to be still very poor, with a vast number of poor who are not integrated into society in the sense of participation. It is not their poverty which really oppresses them, even though that's important. What's important is the fact that they don't sense themselves as participating in the society or see themselves as an underclass in society. Then you can't have good government, because government will be tend to be the only thing that does anything, and it will tend to be very corrupt. So therefore, the only cure for corruption is a good society in which the people are confident of their rights. In the case of Egypt, it's obvious. The question is water. And what everything is done to prevent Egypt from developing. And the crushing of the development is water. The two things are required, of course, large-scale water projects. The Nile project could be improved. What was done to Sudan is an example of the way in which Egypt was attacked from the south by Anglo-American operations. What's happening there now in Sudan is an attack on Sudan, which I warned people in Sudan. I said, Bush is going to destroy your country. And they said, no, Bush has given us assurance. We have people who have talked to Bush people. Bush is going to be good for us, good for burying people, not good for their living. So the problem is that the development of Egypt, the development of the people of that region, the development of the neighboring states of the Nile, the development of water resources, improvement in desalination methods, in greening of the desert. We could do a great deal in this area. If you have a people that's optimistic otherwise, in the general principle of organization of government, the key thing, of course, is you want, the vision is, we don't want really large corporations. You have to have them sometimes for large enterprises. But that's not your conception of economy. The proper conception of the private sector of the economy is highly productive, innovative people who think of building a small enterprise or medium-sized enterprise, which is a family or multi-family institution, a manufacturing something. The higher the skill, the better. But anything that's useful is good. And they have the idea not of making a profit. They don't want to lose money. But a profit is not their motive. Their motive is existential, is to have a way of life of which they can be proud. And they think of building a firm, an enterprise, which will be useful to society. They can walk, be dignified. They can be a physician. They can be something else. They walk with dignity in their society because they know they are to be approved of. They think of they're dying. They think that they're going to leave something behind to people who come after them, either they're members of their family or somebody they like who will keep this thing going. And therefore, the private entrepreneurship of what we call the Mittelstand in Germany is the most normal, most healthy part of the instep structure of the so-called private sector. Therefore, the state, rather than trying to impose by state decree how these firms shall be managed, says, okay, let the farmers decide how to grow the crops. We'll give them assistance. We'll give them the water. We'll give them protection. But let them decide how to grow the crops. Let them perfect themselves. Let them participate intellectually in society. Let's raise their standard of living. Let's improve their education. So therefore, essentially, the division should be between infrastructure and the private sector. And infrastructure should be about 50% of the total economy. And if you find that it's becoming more than 50% of the total economy, you should begin to worry. Because are you putting enough emphasis on private ingenuity? Because you want people who are proud because they are making a significant contribution to society. And you want personal pride, a sense of personal identity. We are not animals. We're human beings. We think in immortal terms. We don't think in mortal terms. Animals think in mortal terms. Human beings think in immortal terms. We think about our ancestors. We think about our descendants. We think about what we're doing in the eyes of our ancestors. We think about what we're doing in terms of our descendants who are coming after us. And so you have to have society organized not as for animals, not as a kennel, but for human beings. And therefore, we wish to have the maximum emphasis upon individual creativity. And therefore, I say the 50% rule is a fairly good estimate from my experience of the United States and looking at other countries.
Thank you. There's one last question for this. Please.
This
might
be our own question.
I hope not.
My name is Gábor Csoftos from Hungary. Actually, I wasn't kidding. It is going to be a long question. It's three questions interconnecting. I'd like Mr. LaRouche's opinion on the failed constitutional referendum, a European referendum by the French and Dutch.
So once again, what's your view on the referendum in France and Holland?
Also interconnected with this, how could you describe the relationship between Western and Eastern Europe within the European Union in terms of social and economic policies? And what could be the underlying policy of the further enlargement of the European Union, if there is any?
For an enlarged or the state, the EU is now, what's the prospect?
Right.
Thank you.
You have a cruel example of what should not be done in what has happened in wage rates for Polish workers in France and Germany, especially the recent thing in France. On the European Union, The point is that the first requirement must be is not a cheap labor requirement. That the, for example, you have people in Poland who had some kind of professional education and qualifications, who were working in Western Europe as hand labor, as unskilled hand labor, at very low wages. This is wrong, morally wrong, unjust, and criminal. Therefore, the question of the protection of the income levels of the people throughout Europe on an equitable basis, not dumping cheap labor from one part of Europe into another part of Europe. This is crucial in defining moral relations. And this, of course, was one of the things which in France, which affected the opposition to the referendum, on the referendum, is because people were working in France, at Eastern European income levels in France, taking French jobs at Eastern European levels. This is the tendency is to destroy. In general, if you look at Eastern Europe, which was formerly dominated by the Soviet Union, and you find the physical economic conditions of life on the average in those countries are worse today than they were under the Soviet system, under Comecon. And they're worse because the people, the authors of the European Union have so decreed it. It's unjust. It's an intrinsic injustice which does no good to anyone. Sooner or later, some of the people in Eastern Europe are going to hate the people in Western and Central Europe because of this kind of policy. They say, we were trained as doctors, we were trained as nurses, we come and we pick your vegetables for you. We do your dirty work for you at low wages. This is not a European Union. This is dirty underwear. So this is wrong. Thus the question, the importance is to maintain the principle of the sovereign nation state. A sovereign nation state is not just an instrument of a political administration. It's an instrument of culture. It's an instrument based on the use of a language. It's based on a shared cultural history from one generation to the other. It's a matter of personal identity within a cultural setting, and locating your personal identity within a cultural setting as a setting within humanity at large. And therefore, we need the institution of the sovereign nation state. We need systems of cooperation among sovereign nation states. We do not need a soup, a minestrone. We need a state. And that's where the problem lies. That the very idea of the European Union was the idea of globalization. The idea of the European Union was the idea of world empire, of destroying the national identity of people in all parts of the world and reducing it to a big minestrone. And that's what's happened. This is evil. Every change in cultural policy which has been made since the Nixon administration worldwide, in general, should be reversed. Just canceled. We should go back to the standard of the sovereign nation state. And I think, you know, when people look at the U.S. standard, and my job in part as an American is to make sure that the American standard, the U.S. standard, is made respectable again by getting rid of some very unrespectable governments and policies we've had recently. But people should be able to look at the United States as what it was intended to be, as an expression of the aspirations of the people of Europe for a system of freedom. We achieved it to a large degree. We were dominated by the British and others, British Empire and others. But we still have preserved some of those things. If we can save that, if we can bring the United States back to what it was in the eyes of the world under Franklin Roosevelt, we in the United States can do something about these things. We can set a standard, we can probably inspire other parts of the world to return to the ideas of the sovereign nation state, to reject globalization, to reject the degradation of people as almost slave labor in countries which used to have dignity.
Thank you, Lynn. So I would ask now my colleague Frank Hahn to read to us the message of greetings by Dr. Noé, the economist, I would say one of the few in this country deserving the name, and the former state secretary in the finance minister, who because of a sudden surgery could not participate at the seminar.
So, greeting address of Dr. Klaus Noé, former Undersecretary of Finances. I would have liked to participate at today's EIR seminar on the subject towards a new Bretton Woods system. Unfortunately, for health reasons, this is impossible for me. Let me contribute some thoughts for the discussion and also wish the seminar a very fruitful debate. For me, it is an important signal that today here in Berlin, people from politics, science, diplomacy, from various countries of Europe, Asia, and the United States come together to formulate and implement alternatives to the highly crisis-ridden global monetary and financial system. And I am glad about this signal. In my different positions in ministries, as well as a writer, I have since the mid-1980s fought for a reorganization of this weak system. First, this means to bring those speculative money flows, which endanger massively the development of the real economy, under control within a new system of stable exchange rates, a new Bretton Woods system. What would be new in this system in comparison to the old system of 1944? First of all, there is the stronger role of Europe, Japan, China, and India in the world economy, which has to be taken into account. Furthermore, it is crucial to avoid from the very beginning the weakness of the old system, namely that the mightiest can inflate his currency and would create new dependencies and instabilities by not respecting certain rules. That poses the question about one currency or a basket of currencies as an anchor for the global monetary system. With a weak dollar, only a basket of currencies could help. I know that Mr. LaRouche is campaigning for a strengthening of the dollar through rebuilding and expanding the physical economy of the United States. That is a crucial undertaking, but it poses a set of new questions about the relationship between the United States, Asia, and Europe, which would be rather inspiring to discuss. Especially, I do not assume that the present monetary and financial system could simply go on until the United States have reduced the different deficits. And this will be impossible without a further visible drop in the value of the dollar. Can an overvalued currency be the anchor currency? I hope very much to participate during the next seminar. For today, I wish all of you a successful discussion. Dr. Klaus Noé.
Very good.
I would now ask Dr. Lettieri to come to the podium address us. Dr. Lettieri from the Italian National Parliament in Rome is the initiator of the new financial architecture cross-party motion, which overwhelmingly passed the Italian Parliament last March.
Testing.
So there will be simultaneous translation.
Intanto io ringrazio per
l'invito a partecipare a questo importante incontro.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for the invitation to take part in this very important meeting.
Dopo l'ampia, puntuale relazione del professore La Roche, oggettivamente io devo cambiare un po' i termini del mio intervento che avevo, diciamo, pensato.
Following the very wide-ranging and profound presentation by Professor La Roche, I've had to change my plans for my intervention and shift in a different direction.
I temi in discussione sono di grande attualità e chiedono ai democratici veri e ai riformisti di tutto il mondo, di tutti i paesi, ma soprattutto a quelli dei paesi cosiddetti sviluppati, a partire dagli Stati Uniti d'America, richiedono impegni e azioni concrete.
The themes that have been introduced are extremely relevant and they require intellectuals and professionals in every part of the world, but particularly in the United States, a particular commitment in order to solve the problems that have been identified.
In quest'ottica, nel mio ruolo di parlamentare, sollecitato dal professor Raimondi, che saluto, come certamente saprete, ho posto tale problema, quello della modifica del sistema monetario e finanziario internazionale, all'attenzione della Camera dei Deputati nel mio paese, in Italia.
As a member of Parliament and on the invitation of Paolo Raimondi, whom I'd like to greet here, as you probably know, I proposed to the Parliament of my country, Italy, a proposal for the reform of the financial and monetary system.
La Camera dei Deputati, in data 6 aprile, approvava la mozione da me presentata ed impegnava il governo italiano ad attivarsi nelle sedi internazionali per costruire una nuova architettura finanziaria finalizzata ad evitare futuri crack finanziari ed il ripetersi di bolle speculative, e quindi orientata all'obiettivo di sostenere l'economia reale, di cui ha parlato tanto il professor La Roche, e ad intraprendere quindi tutte le iniziative necessarie, insieme alle altre nazioni, per arrivare alla convocazione di una conferenza internazionale a livello di capi di Stato e di Governo per definire un nuovo e più giusto sistema monetario e finanziario.
The Parliament in Rome on the 6th of April approved the proposal that I had presented, and it committed itself as well to appeal to the government to become active internationally in order to build a new financial architecture, in order to prevent future speculative bubbles and also to prevent future financial crash scenarios. This proposal also called on the government to sustain the real economy, as Mr. La Roche has developed the idea today, and therefore to take all necessary initiatives to convoke an international conference at the level of the heads of state and governments in order to define a new and more just world economic and monetary system.
La mia iniziativa partiva dagli scandali italiani Parmalat e Cirio, dalle vicende degli Stati Uniti della società Enron e da quella dei bond argentini, che per la prima volta scaturiva dal default di uno Stato sovrano. Queste
Okay, my initiative actually was prompted by the scandals in Italy of Parmalat and Cirio, which you've heard about, as well as the very big scandal in the United States of Enron, and of course the Argentine bond issue, where for the first time a sovereign state was defaulting.
Queste vicende ritengo siano soltanto la punta di un iceberg di una situazione più grave di cui non vi è sufficiente consapevolezza. Sono la punta di un iceberg di quel fallimento al quale faceva riferimento nella sua dotta relazione il professor LaRouche.
I believe that these things are merely the tip of an iceberg of a much greater, much graver and larger phenomenon, which of course Mr. LaRouche has developed today, but which are not taken into consideration adequately generally.
In ogni paese, quindi anche soprattutto oggi nei paesi cosiddetti sviluppati, incominciano ad avvertirsi in maniera sempre più pungente gli effetti negativi della finanziarizzazione dell'economia, la concentrazione del potere e delle ricchezze in poche mani, l'aumento delle disuguaglianze nei singoli stati e tra i diversi stati del mondo, o peggio, tra i diversi continenti. Si pensi al continente africano in questo caso.
Yes, in every country, particularly in the developed countries, we see more and more every day the negative effects of the financialization of the economy, of the transformation of economic processes into financial processes. The concentration of power in very few hands, the lack of equality in single countries and among various countries, and of course even the lack of equality among continents. Here I'm thinking of the case of Africa, which was also cited.
Non parlerò delle questioni relative al continente africano, che vivo come persona che crede in un mondo più giusto e migliore, vivo in maniera drammatica le varie vicende che vedono milioni e milioni di persone vittime della povertà, di malattie e così via, ma su questo terreno non mi voglio dilungare. Voglio invece sottolineare un aspetto che il professore ha evidenziato, quello della rincorsa nella delocalizzazione delle attività produttive da un paese all'altro, che sta interessando molto anche il mio paese, per cui vi è un impoverimento del tessuto produttivo, un aumento della disoccupazione e diventa, a mio avviso, una catena, perché gli investimenti produttivi oggi si spostano dall'Italia, dalla parte nord dell'Italia, anziché nel sud del mio paese dove c'è molta disoccupazione, si spostano in Romania, in Polonia, in Slovenia, in Tunisia, in Turchia, ma domani, quando le condizioni di vita di quei paesi aumenteranno, le condizioni di lavoro e di salario dei lavoratori polacchi, sloveni e così via, ci sarà un altro spostamento dove il costo del lavoro sarà, diciamo, ritenuto inferiore. Non si va da nessuna parte a lungo andare, credo io.
I won't speak of the situation in Africa. However, I must say I live the condition, the crisis of Africa, as a great drama, a great personal drama. But I will not speak of the disease, the war, and social dislocation. What I do want to do is to stress one aspect that was raised by Mr. LaRouche, and that is the outsourcing of production out of the United States and Europe, because this is also hitting Italy quite hard right now. It has led to the impoverishment of the social structures and unemployment, as well as a chain effect of the following type. Instead of having investment go from northern Italy, which is relatively developed, into southern Italy, where it is greatly required, investment is going from northern Italy to Romania, to Poland, to Slovenia, to Tunisia, and to Turkey. And I can already anticipate that tomorrow, when the conditions are improved in these various countries where investment is being made, there will be the tendency to look for other areas where one can outsource production, where the wage levels will be even lower.
Come è noto, ovviamente, molti effetti negativi nei cosiddetti paesi occidentali incominciano ad aversi per l'arrivo di merci dalla Cina a basso costo, perché in Cina il costo del lavoro diciamo inferiore rispetto a quello dei paesi occidentali. Ed interi settori economici, come il tessile, stanno entrando in crisi. L'Italia era un paese grande produttore di questi beni e oggi vive in maniera molto seria questa crisi in regioni importanti come la Toscana, ma anche le regioni meridionali.
As is known, many negative effects have been seen in the countries of the West, deriving from the imports of cheap products from China, for example, where wage levels are much lower and therefore products can be produced and sold at much lower prices. Entire economic sectors are being hit by these cheap imports, for example, the textile sector. In Italy, the textile sector used to be a very prominent one, very productive, but now it has fallen into a serious crisis, not only in Tuscany, but also in the southern part of the country.
I problemi quindi non hanno dimensioni locali limitati ad una singola nazione, ma sono molto più complessi e riguardano l'intero globo. Finora le agenzie e gli organismi internazionali, dalla Banca Mondiale al Fondo Monetario Internazionale, all'Organizzazione per il Commercio Mondiale e i vari incontri del G8 e così via, non si sono dimostrati adeguati di fronte alla enormità e alla complessità dei problemi. E spesso, e questo mi è sembrato anche di capire sempre dalla dotta relazione del professor La Russa, che gli stessi governi siano del tutto inconsapevoli o vittime o succubi dei cosiddetti spiriti animali di questo capitalismo finanziario attestato da un lato a un grande sistema bancario, dall'altro non più ai grandi industriali del passato che avevano comunque dei meriti perché erano dei produttori. Oggi ci troviamo dinanzi invece ad un capitalismo speculatore che sposta anche con il sistema telematico nel giro di pochi secondi masse enorme di risorse finanziarie, arricchendo o impoverendo, diciamo, di volta in volta il singolo paese dal quale essi muovono questi capitali.
So the problems are not at all local and do not just affect a single country, but they are much more complex and affect the entire globe. From what I've heard, it's very clear that the international institutions thus far, like the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, as well as the G8, have not demonstrated an adequate understanding of the complexity of the problems. And as Mr. LaRouche presented it, it also appears to be the case that these governments themselves are either unaware of this fact or are influenced by the fact of this so-called bestial capitalism and the big financial banking systems that actually are controlling the economies. These are not the great industrial systems that we had in the past, which were extremely productive, but we're dealing here with banking systems, financial systems, which are based on purely speculative activities, whereby huge masses of money, of funds, are transferred from one place to another within a few minutes, bringing great profits to those who invest them, but impoverishing entire countries.
Occorre perciò rivedere l'attuale sistema monetario e finanziario, l'attuale politica di cooperazione e sostegno allo sviluppo. E spero che vi sia dalla parte dell'ONU e dalla stessa Unione Europea, verso la quale ho notato una non positiva predisposizione da parte del professor La Russa, mentre io su questo devo dire che in un certo senso dissento, perché ritengo che l'Unione Europea, che ha subito un grave colpo con la mancata approvazione in Francia e in Olanda del trattato di costituzionale, però ritengo che la Unione Europea possa svolgere anche in questo campo della riforma di un sistema monetario e finanziario a livello internazionale, possa agire come singolo Stato e avere un effetto, una, come dire, svolgere un'azione estremamente positiva.
Therefore, we absolutely have to review the entire financial and economic system and the policy of development. I hope that the United Nations and the EU will play a role in this concern. The EU is something that Mr. LaRouche has shown, he's displayed a not positive predisposition to the European Union. And here I must dissent, because I believe that the EU, which was recently hit very hard by the no vote in France and Netherlands on the Constitution, I believe that the EU still can play a role as if a single state in the process of creating a new and more just monetary and financial system internationally.
Fatti nuovi comunque si stanno registrando, se si pensa che si vanno consolidando le democrazie nei paesi dell'America Latina, c'è l'evoluzione democratica di un'intera parte di stati che gravitavano nell'orbita dell'Unione Sovietica. Io saluto anche qui i rappresentanti di quell'area, ho avuto modo di comprendere che vi è una crescita del sistema democratico e soprattutto poi la presenza di questo nuovo protagonismo dei paesi asiatici, dalla Cina all'India alla Corea, di cui anche gli Stati Uniti d'America incominciano a sentire gli effetti, diciamo, forti della presenza sui mercati, ma prima o poi dovranno anche in sede politica avere un peso maggiore oggettivamente e quindi dovranno, come dire, avere considerazione in questa riforma che noi andiamo a che si prospetta come necessità, la riforma del sistema attuale monetario e finanziario.
There are several new facts that must be registered worldwide which are positive. For example, I see a process of democratization in countries of Latin America and also in those Eastern European countries or those in the former sphere of the Soviet Union, and I would like to greet the representatives of these countries here today. Another important fact to note is the new role of Asian countries like China, India, and Korea in the world economy. The United States is apparently also beginning to note their presence, at least on the markets, and these countries will have to be given a larger political weight in world politics. And also, in my view, they must be brought into the process of creation of a new monetary and financial system worldwide.
Mi sembra ovvio che un nuovo ordine finanziario globale e la proposta di una nuova Bretton Woods non possa prescindere dal coinvolgimento di grandi realtà come quella cinese, non fosse altro per il peso demografico ed economico che questa ha, la Cina, l'India e tutto il sistema poi dei paesi dell'ex Unione Sovietica. Alcuni problemi e poi chiudo.
Well, it's very obvious that when we're talking about building a new international financial monetary system, a new Bretton Woods, we cannot exclude great countries like China, India and others which have an extremely important demographic weight as well as an economic function in the world economy. This also goes for the former areas of the countries which were in the sphere of the Soviet Union. Now there are just a couple of problems I would like to raise in conclusion.
È stato posto l'accento sul ruolo più incisivo dello Stato. E allora sorgono alcuni problemi. Già dalle domande di qualche amico io traggo, diciamo, spunto nel dire quello che sto per dire. come coniugare la libertà di impresa e la libertà nell'economia, inquadrandola, diciamo, in un'ottica per favorire sicuramente lo sviluppo, o meglio il ritorno ad un'economia reale e produttiva che possa produrre ricchezza tangibile e non pura speculazione, e quindi creare maggiore occupazione. La domanda è questa: un ruolo eccessivo dello Stato, professore, poi lei trarrà le conclusioni, un ruolo eccessivo dello Stato può portare a delle degenerazioni che abbiamo avuto in una vasta area dell'Europa, c'è stata già. Io credo che bisognerebbe individuare una terza via che sappia conciliare bene la libertà di impresa e economia con un ruolo di governo, diciamo, dei processi economici. Come riferimento però la libertà d'impresa deve essere anche un punto fermo.
Ok. You have stressed the role of the state in your remarks, which has raised a couple of problems. In fact, I saw in some of the questions raised here that this issue can be problematic. These questions that were raised have stimulated my question now. How can you link the freedom of the economy, the freedom of a company to move as it will economically, in order to return to a productive economy where it produces tangible wealth, not speculation, and also generates employment? How can you link this freedom of the economy, free economy, to the role of the state? Because I have seen an excessive role of the state, for example, in the Eastern Europe, can lead to a degeneration of the economy. And I think we have to identify a third way in which we can guarantee that a free economy can coexist with a strong state.
In pratica noi abbiamo, questo mi dice la mia limitatissima esperienza, governi deboli nell'orientare gli investimenti per creare ricchezza reale e dall'altro governi subalterni ai grandi sistemi finanziari, per cui che cosa si verifica? Che gli scandali ai quali io ho fatto riferimento nel mio paese, ma a livello mondiale ce ne sono tanti, vengono, come dire, a sfuggire a quelle che sono le regole del singolo paese. Troppe operazioni finanziarie sfuggono ad ogni tipo di vigilanza esercitata nell'interesse pubblico. Servono quindi regole certe, perché i mercati non hanno più confini per quanto riguarda la finanza, e regole certe condivise a livello mondiale. Noi non riusciamo neanche a condividere per intero tutte le regole a livello di Unione Europea. Il professore sicuramente avrà seguito un grande dibattito nel mio paese sulla riforma del risparmio e delle autorità di vigilanza. Non siamo riusciti ancora a trovare, come dire, un punto di condivisione, mentre almeno a livello europeo bisognerà trovare regole certe per evitare questi scandali finanziari e forse per andare verso una tassazione di un certo tipo. Io faccio riferimento a Tobin, la Tobin Tax, per limitare almeno la portata di queste speculazioni.
In practice we have many weak governments who are incapable of generating investments for productive activities. But on the other hand, we also have governments which are subjected to the control of powerful international financial institutions, and they have acted in such a way as to produce the scandalous cases that I mentioned before, Parmalat, Chirio, Enron. These are groups which manage to escape the rules of the game. They manage to avert the regulations that are established in any one country. And there are too many big financial processes and groups which are able to evade any kind of regulation. What we need is regulation on a worldwide scale. However, we have not even been able to reach agreement at the level of the European Union. And even in, within Italy, there's disagreement still on the question of the reform of the savings system. At the EU level, we need absolutely regulation in order to prevent further scandals. And I have spoken about the possibility of introducing a tax, something like the Tobin tax, which would be a way of regulating and at least identifying speculative flows.
Prima di concludere e ringraziarvi per la pazienza dimostrata nell'ascoltare queste mie disorganiche considerazioni, io ritengo che ognuno di noi debba fare uno sforzo perché di questi problemi si parli di più a livello istituzionale. Nei singoli parlamenti occorre agire perché sono problemi che di solito il singolo parlamentare non segue per il ritmo e gli impegni quotidiani, è indotto a non riflettere sulla drammaticità. Io ritengo drammatica la situazione e vi è il rischio per le nuove generazioni di trovarsi in un'epoca più buia. Il bene comune a cui è stato fatto riferimento molto spesso non c'è nella mente e nel cuore di chi ricopre una carica istituzionale. Dobbiamo fare tutti uno sforzo perché si ritorni, diciamo, a questa idea di fondo del bene comune e, se volete, anche a una giusta dose di utopia per un mondo migliore. Grazie.
Thank you. Now, before I finish, and thank you for your patience listening to these disconnected thoughts, I want to make an appeal, and that is that everyone has to make a very serious effort at the level of every parliament as well to deal with these issues. It has to be said that the single parliamentarian often doesn't have the time or is not able for other reasons to reflect on the very dramatic situation we are living through, and I want to emphasize the dramatic situation. If we do not address these issues at the required level, there's the risk that the new generations will find themselves in a dark age. So I am calling for a common commitment, which right now is not there at the level of most institutions. We must call on all to fight for the common good, and also with a good dose of utopian outlook for a better world. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Once again, thank you, Dr. Lettieri, and as you raised a number of very significant questions to Mr. LaRouche directly, I would propose in concluding this morning session that Lynn directly responds.
Well, let me start with one thing, an observation on this question of freedom, as he referred to it in a number of points in the report. Some years ago, I saw the opportunity of, or the challenge of meeting the potential of a youth movement inside the United States and elsewhere. Now, the need for the youth movement, which comes largely from what happened in Western Europe and the United States under Harry Truman and company, or under Henry B. Luce and company, in the creation of a fascist organization called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which I've called the Congress for Cultural Fornication. This institution, which presumably was to educate people in the United States, in Western Europe in particular, and to penetrate Eastern Europe on behalf of democracy, actually was one of the greatest insults to freedom ever concocted. It was based on ideas typified by those of Bertolt Brecht, a very evil person, a reputed leftist, who imposed a kind of fascism, which was called liberalism, in the effort to try to destroy those elements of European culture, including in the United States, which had been responsible for what these people objected to. People like Theodore Adorno, Horkheimer, Arendt, who were close friends of that Nazi, Martin Heidegger. And therefore, what's happened is there was a curse on creativity, actual creativity, which I observed. I came out of World War II, you know, as some people did. And I came back to the United States, which I had left when it was under Roosevelt, to the United States under Truman. And I found that the people who were actually responsible for putting Hitler into power originally, some of whom who objected to him when he turned westward in his attacks rather than eastward, had gone back at the end of Roosevelt's death to trying to take German troops out of prison camps and send them against the Soviet Union then. And these people, under Churchill and under Truman, had taken over. These were the people who dropped the two bombs unnecessarily on Hiroshima and Nagasaki for no good purpose. They simply to terrify the world and to get the nuclear war going. Now what happened is the generation which was born during the war or immediately afterward was educated under the impact in the United States and Europe of the Congress for Cultural Freedom or the Congress for Cultural Degeneration. Now these young people were influenced by, they had to prove they were anti-communists. They were the perfect sophists. They had no morality whatsoever. And this was true in Western Europe. It was especially true in France. You see the cultural effects of the Congress for Cultural Freedom. So we produced a generation which became known as the 68ers, which under the stress of the missile crisis of 1962, under the stress of the opening of the war in Indochina by the United States, went crazy and became known as the 68ers. And they were associated with what was called a cultural paradigm shift. The essential feature, the destructive feature of this, was the denial of the existence of rational creativity. The epitome of this degeneration is the Greenie phenomenon in Germany today, the anti-nuclear phenomenon. So the emphasis on irrationality of this particular type is what has been responsible culturally for a transformation of the economies of the United States, Western Europe, and elsewhere, from economies which, with all their defects, political defects, were not net producers and net growers up into the middle of the 1960s and somewhat beyond, into societies which were self-inflicted processes of degeneration, of economic and moral degeneration, which we had today. Now in 1989, at the time that the so-called Berlin Wall fell, my generation was still in a leading position in governmental and related power, typified by the Alfred Herrhausen, who was murdered by that year because by people who didn't want Germany to survive, at least in a progressive form. And what we've had since then is the emergence of a generation, the so-called baby boomer generation, which took over the United States and Europe. These were the people who, by and large, were corrupted by the sophistry and the pure systemic sophistry of the Congress for Cultural Freedom. You cannot get a decent performance of any classical drama in Germany or in Austria today. You can't do it. The actors don't exist. The classical European culture has been destroyed. In scientific education has been virtually destroyed, reduced to textbook education. The process of discovery of ideas is gone. It is not in the educational system. If I want an intelligent person in science, I look for someone who is in their late 70s or 80s. As in the former Soviet Union today. This So the past 15 years since the fall of the wall has been a period of accelerated cultural degeneration as the baby boomer generation took over from the preceding generation. The result is that the young people of today, young adults, 18 to 25, do not hate their parents, except in some cases, but the healthy ones don't hate their parents. They have contempt for them. They have contempt for them because they look at them as people who are waiting to die without being aware of it, who are living out lifestyles, not pursuing goals, who are hostile to creativity, who are interested in protecting their prejudices, their acquired habits, not open. Now, what I found was this about 1999, this development within the United States became obvious and also was reflected in Europe at about the same time. We began to get a youth movement in the United States. And I, knowing, understanding these things, I kept the youth movement separate from the adult part of the organization, the older adult part of the organization, because the older adults hated what the youth represented, because they represented a threat to the lifestyle culture of the baby boomer generation, which is a product of demoralization of this process. Now, what we've got is the following. I set two standards for the self-education, and it's largely self-education, of these youths. Standard number one, Gauss. Gauss, 1799, attack on D'Alembert, Euler, and Lejeune. So, this worked. This meant going back to classical Greece to understand the origin of these ideas of science, which were modern ideas of modern science. This meant going to classical culture, and we used things like the Bach Jesu Meine Freude, and we also things like the Mozart Ave Verum Corpus as programs which are used by the youth in a self-education program. Now, as a result, we have a young generation which, after several years of this, have actually become proficient in understanding concepts such as some of those of Riemann and similar people, which are incomprehensible to people with professorships in science in many universities today. The difference is very simple. These young people have concentrated on the creative processes of mind. The creative processes of mind are the definition of freedom. The ability of a human being to distinguish himself from a monkey, which some baby boomers have trouble doing, is the problem. And therefore, the baby boomer generation tends to be oppressive toward the younger generation because they're trying to cling to the lifestyle, which is their reaction formation to the impact of the Congress for Cultural Freedom on the culture of Western Europe and Central Europe and the Americas. What has happened is you have some of us who come from a somewhat younger baby boomer generation who are distinct, who have not shared this corruption. This includes a significant number of people who, by a selective process, have risen to positions of importance in the U.S. government, especially in the Senate, in some of the special branches of the executive branch, professions of the executive branch. They still cling to a knowledgeable understanding of the cultural heritage of the United States and are responsive to it. So the question of freedom today must not be, as by the professor just indicated, must not be looked at as a problem of a system of government inherently. It's a problem of the way in which a system of government has been used. Because if we have a society which is oriented to promoting in educational systems, in forms of employment, to laughing at the greenies as being a disease, and laughing at them so we won't kill them, ridiculing them because we don't want to kill them, because they are hateful people. They have been destroying our culture. They've been destroying our civilization. The denial of nuclear energy in Europe and other parts of the world is a crime against humanity. The denial of technological progress is a crime against humanity. These ideas, which were spread under the influence of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, have been the oppression. If we get rid of that, and if we go back to the ideas of promoting individual creativity and the right of all individual young people, children and others, to be educated in a way which promotes their creativity, which gives freedom to the expression of their creativity, then you will not have an oppressive society. The oppression of society is not a systemic one. The problem does not lie with the systems of government or the systems of the state. It lies with the way the systems of government and state have been abused under the influence of this process, which was set into motion by those such as Churchill, Bertrand Russell, Truman, and so forth, who launched the Cold War, as it became to be known. And this kind of cultural sophistry, the sophistry which has destroyed cultures in the past, has corrupted the people themselves. And the only correction for corruption of the people is to inspire them to discover the true humanity in themselves. And I find that the work of these young people does that. I find that when people are inspired by hope, that their tendency for freedom is increased. Their respect for freedom is increased. When you try to find a solution in making the rules, always making the rules, the making of the rules by those who make the rules becomes a form of oppression. And therefore, what the professor said is extremely important. But you have to understand the source of the disease and the cure. The cure of the disease is to promote creativity among our young people so that people in the 18 to 25 age group, which is the transition from juvenile and ages into adult ages, adulthood. This is the crucial period. If we produce en masse young people who are inspired to be creative, who like creativity, who enjoy classical culture and what it represents, who enjoy scientific discovery and what it represents, not learning from a textbook, but reenacting the act of discovery. If we do that, then we create a people who are characteristic of freedom. We have an example right here in Germany. You had a terrible situation in Germany, or an oppressive situation, in the middle of the 18th century. Into this came people such as the Lessing and Moses Mendelssohn. And they started a classical revolution in Germany, which spread from Germany back into England. Shakespeare didn't exist in England in the 18th century until late, until Lessing discovered it in Germany and revived it for the world. And thus we found that classical periods, periods of classical revolution, periods of fluorescence of creative thinking, such as the 15th century Renaissance, centered on Florence. These kinds of periods are the periods which produce the idea of freedom and induce the practice of freedom. And the problem is not so much the imposition of forms of society which are unfree, but the allowing of ourselves to become subjugated to the stultifying effect of dead ideology, of a hatred and estrangement from creativity. Whenever people have become creative and are inspired by their own creativity, they tend to revolt, as they have at all periods of classical culture in European history and other parts of history. Take, for example, the great Arab Renaissance, which occurred in what was called today Iraq. Under people like Al-Farabi and so forth, and not others. This classical renaissance inspired a culture. The same thing has happened in the European Renaissance. It happened in Greece. When Greece was in its bad state, the Pythagoreans and Solon and people of that type, and people like, after a bad period, people like Plato, inspired a classical revolution which reverberates in the world still today, it echoes. So the key thing here on these questions is if we organize society around the idea of scientific and cultural creativity, if we inspire ourselves by a devotion not to competition, a Hobbesian competition, but inspire ourselves by a commitment to find the advantage of the other nation, the other people. What do they need from us? If we all concentrate on what the other nation needs from us, we shall get along quite nicely.
So this ends the morning panel. We will now have a lunch break of exactly 1 hour.